Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Before introducing today's guest, I want to let listeners know that we've just released a bonus Econ Talk interview with economist and Nobel laureate Paul Romer, recorded just a few days ago on May 12, 2020, talking about where we are with the COVID-19 pandemic and the potential for widespread, inexpensive testing to help get our lives back to something vaguely like normal. You can listen to it in our normal feed, but you can also watch the video of the conversation on the Econ Talk YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube and search for Econ Talk. And now for today's episode. Today's February 18th, 2020, and my guest is journalist, author, and former teacher Robert Pondicio of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, where he is a senior fellow. He is the author of How the Other Half Learns, Equality, Excellence, and the Battle Over School Choice. Robert, welcome to Econ Talk.
Thanks, Russ.
This book is about a controversial set of charter schools in the New York City area under the direction of Eva Moskowitz, called the Success Academy. And I just want to say up front that I was deeply moved by the book. I learned a lot from the book. And most of all, I thought it was just wonderful how thoughtful the book is in finding nuance in how and what we can learn from the experience that you had spending a year in a particular school in this chain of charter schools. But I want to start with your story first, a little bit about it. You used to be a school teacher. How'd that happen, and what happened?
Still am. I teach part-time to this day at a charter school called Democracy Prep in Harlem. One day a week, I teach civics. But no, I was a mid-career switcher. I had a whole other life in the magazine business. I worked for Time and Business Week. And in what I now describe candidly as a mid-career impulse purchase, I signed up to be an inner city school teacher in the South Bronx under a program called the New York City Teaching Fellows.
How old were you?
39. Mm-hmm. So genuinely mid-career. Not like the 24 and 25-year-olds who were in the program who'd had one other job out of college. But no, I signed up to do 2 years of teaching fifth grade at a school called PS 277 in the South Bronx. 2 years turned into five. Education kind of became unwittingly my second career. And I'm still obviously in it to this day.
How'd you come to write this book? How'd you get the idea for it? And what were the logistics of being able to wander around school talking to teachers, staff, parents, students for a year?
Yeah, those are a lot of questions. Let me tick them off one by one. Like a lot of folks in this work, I became fascinated by Success Academy and Eva Moskowitz. I mean, if you're paying attention to schools, particularly if you're like me, you're paying attention to inner city schools, then they're unavoidable. A few years ago, I remember writing a piece for the New York Daily News that asked, I think the question was, is Eva Moskowitz the Michael Jordan of standardized testing or the Mark McGuire? And those of our listeners who are sports people will get the reference, you know, Michael Jordan being this fantastic athlete and Mark McGuire being a notorious steroids cheater. The reason I wrote that piece was this was when Common Core testing had first hit. Everybody's tests fell out of bed. Theirs went up. And not just up, but they were strong across their network. In other words, there was no such thing as, and still is not, a bad Success Academy. So you can't be interested in this and not wonder, as I think the title of the piece was, what the hell is going on up there? So at that point, I remember writing saying, look, somebody should go up there and, you know, and do this and find out how they're getting these results. Didn't intend it for it to be me, but a few years later, I talked my way into Success Academy. And I think what enabled me to do that is I occupy a strange space in education policy discussions, Russ. A lot of folks, as you know, in the policy world tend to talk about the structures of education, chartering, testing, accountability. I'm the guy who tends to say, well, that's all fine, but can we talk about what the kids do all day?
Yeah, what's happening on the ground.
Yeah, curriculum, which, instruction.
Which is treated as sort of a black box. You know, we set up the right to get the right program in place, and then it'll all just kind of
I'm glad that you seem to agree with me that that's an unusual position to take. But look, hey, you're an economist, so that's what economists yeah. do, right?
Well, we try, but I think this black box metaphor, I think, is a real problem in this field because we think we've got some magic bullet, something that's going to cure this particular disease, and we just assume that once we pass the legislation or hand out the money, everything's going to be fine.
Well, I would actually argue that it's a little bit even worse than that. And maybe this is born of my experience having been a classroom teacher and having gone to ed school. I mean, the logic of education reform, broadly speaking, is what? We don't need to know what happens inside that black box. We just need to measure what comes out of it. That's predicated on the assumption, right, that schools and teachers know what to do, and so the only thing that matters is the outcome. Well, having been through ed school and having taught, I'm not a teacher basher, but let me assure you, if you assume that all we need to do is either incentivize proper behavior or counsel out the laggards, I don't know where that idea came from.
And you talk about how when you were teaching as a new teacher that you'd go to your principal and say, so what should I be teaching?
Yeah.
And what was the reaction? Which is shocking. People will be shocked at the reaction.
People should be shocked because they think I'm making this up. But talk to a new teacher. Look, it wasn't just because I was in a so-called alternative certification program and got 6 weeks of basically teacher boot camp before being given the keys to the classroom. Very little in teacher preparation education schools concerns itself with the practical knowledge of teaching. I know you've had Doug Lamov on this podcast before. This is what makes his work so powerful, is he's giving teachers what they really need, which is stand still when asking questions, practice handing out papers, cold call students. I mean, just nuts and bolts of teaching that most schools of education don't think is their job. And this extends to curriculum. In other words, my classroom was full of people who wanted to tell me how to teach. And when I, in my naivete, asked the question, well, what should I be teaching? I always got some variation of the answer, well, Mr. Pandisio, you're the best person to know what every child needs. And I found that answer, and still do, quite unhelpful.
I was sitting next to a teacher. I may have told the story on the air before, but I was sitting next to a teacher once on an airplane and asked her what she taught. And she was a math teacher. I don't remember the grade. It was between 6th and 8th, and I'll just say it was 7th. And I'd say, well, what are you covering there? And she said, well, 7th grade's kind of a review year. And I thought, well, that's a strange
that doesn't sound
strategy.
Right.
Yeah, that doesn't sound right. I don't know whether she was told it was to be a review year. I don't know whether that was the way it was structured in her school. I don't know whether that was her way of feeling good about the fact they didn't learn anything new. I don't know. Anyway, you spend a year in this fascinating environment of the Success Academy, mm-hmm. which makes it sound like
it's a particular school.
Right,
yes.
But Success Academy is a chain.
That's right.
You mentioned that you have to deal with them if you're in this world. Why? What is their – give us a few metrics of their success. It's extraordinary.
Sure.
When you read it and you assume it's not a lie,
yeah.
It is extraordinary.
Well, I'll give you some data, and well, maybe this may not be precise. This is from memory, so please don't tweet at me if I've got this wrong. Last year, there were approximately 50 Success Academy schools, all of them in New York City, mostly elementary schools, some middle, one or two high schools. Under the law of the land, every kid gets tested right now, grades 3 through 8 in math and reading. That's been the law of the land for 20 years. So last year, of those 50 schools, about 36, 37 of them had so-called testing grades, 3 through 8. Of those, the poorest performing school had, again, from memory, 85% of their kids at or above grade level in reading. All the other ones were better. In math, 92% of – that was the worst one. That was the weak sister. 92% of kids on or above grade level in math, and it's mostly way above. And to be clear, these are approximately 90% of the kids are low-income kids of color. So they are doing the thing that ed reform has said for years can be done, which is taking our most disadvantaged students, historically speaking, and raising them not just to the levels of achievement, but where they are, where the Scarsdales of the world are now chasing them.
And if I remember two of the five top performing in 2016 when you were there, two of the five top performing schools in math in the whole system were these system.
If it's in New York City, it's all but one or two of them. And that includes the gifted and talented programs and whatnot. I mean, if they were a standalone school district in the state of New York, Russ, they would be by far the best performing school district based on test scores. You always have to make that caveat.
Correct.
There's more to schooling than test
scores. We'll talk about
that. But based on test scores, Success Academy as a standalone school district would be by a considerable distance the highest performing district in the state of New York.
And when you wrote your book in 2016, when you spent this year there, there were 41 schools with 14,000 students. There are now, you said about 50. I think there's 47, at least on the Wikipedia page I saw, with 17,000. And you think, you know, part of me exalts, and there are some very, I was brought to tears a couple places in the book at the emotional gratitude and success that these kids are experiencing and that their parents are grateful for. And it's glorious to think that there's 17,000 students getting a shot. Yep. And then you've got to remember that there's 1.1 million kids in the New York City school system. And it's breaks your heart.
Sure.
So we'll get to that. Before we do, one more definition or a definition. This is a charter school system. Mm-hmm. It was started by two, if I remember, hedge fund managers or investors.
That's right. They wrote the original charter.
Very wealthy people. They saw Eva Moskowitz, who was a phenomenon, and decided she was going to be the person to lead it. They started with one school.
Yep.
There's now 47. Why aren't there 70 or 100 or 200? And what's distinctive about a charter school?
Yeah. Well, if Eva Moskowitz, the CEO, had her way, there would be 100. At the moment, we're hard up against the charter school cap in the state of New York. So there are no more charters to be given out politically at the moment. So that's the first problem right there is that they become politically unpopular, particularly on the left, which is ironic given that the kids that they tend to serve best tend to be low-income kids of color in urban environments. But what is a charter school? I always forget to remind people of this because I assume they know and they don't. A charter school is a public school insofar as it does not charge tuition and has open admissions. But basically, it's government-funded and privately run. So it is not a private school. It is privately managed. Most charters in America, all of them in New York, all of them at Success Academy, are not-for-profit. But you know they are again government funded but privately run.
And you know Eva Moskowitz, you tell this great story of when she came out of politics.
Yeah.
She wanted to earn $175,000. Thought that wouldn't probably be available to her when these two investors sought her out. And they said, "Well, I'm going to show. We're going to really be a bad negotiator. We'll give you $250,000."
Yeah.
And so she's off the chart, literally. There's no chart. She's free of the bureaucracy. She's paid whatever the people who founded the system want to pay her. Their teachers are paid wherever they want. They decide their own classroom size. They happen to be large. Many of them are 30 or more, which is kind of shocking.
Yes.
They don't have any union rules. They're semi-private in the sense they're nonprofit, semi-private, publicly funded.
That's right.
But Eva Moskowitz's salary. I mean, what?
Oh, she gets a lot of grief for paying herself a fairly nice sum of money. It's, I think, north of $500,000 now. So I'm sure I haven't looked it up, but I'm relatively sure she makes more money than the school's chancellor in the city of New York. But it always reminds me of this story that somebody once asked Babe Ruth whether it was okay for him to make more money than the president. And he said, well, I had a better year than him.
Yeah.
So Moskowitz is having a better year.
She's having a good decade. But her salary is not set by the city of New York.
No. It's set by her board.
But where does her budget come from? In other words, when we say it's publicly funded, how much of those funds come to her, school system?
I will be honest. One of the my own self-critiques in the book is I didn't really spend a lot of time digging into the finances of Success Academy, frankly, because it's just been done. I mean, my particular niche is to write about classroom practice and culture. So I'll forgive myself, but I should have the answer to that.
That's okay.
They charters are publicly funded insofar as you get reimbursed for every student you enroll. And it's generally speaking a little bit less than what the city of New York would pay for, or the state of New York would pay on average for a student. But they also are peerless fundraisers. They raise a lot of money at these glittering events that they do and whatnot. So, look, I just find it odd. I'm not even Moskowitz's cheerleader. Let me be, or defender here. Let me be clear on that.
It's clear in the book.
Thank you. Appreciate that. But I just find it odd that she gets dinged for her salary. Not only because of the performance, but having worked in the private sector for so many years, I always think to myself, do you have any idea how much money this woman would make in the private in the private sector with her ability to kind of just put her stamp on a school culture? I've never seen a corporate culture that's as consistent and coherent as I saw at Success Academy.
And we had a discussion on those issues with Dan Pallotta. We'll put a link up to that episode and why his argument that nonprofits, if we think they're doing important work, and they almost always are, should be paid accordingly to attract great talent to do the things that we think are worth doing. One other issue before we get to the year, a lot more people want to attend these schools than there are seats available. You said, there's no more schools available. The number of literal seats available in school is limited by the physical plant and other issues. The documentary Waiting for Superman is about, if I remember correctly, a Success Academy school.
That's right.
And it's an extraordinary, powerful documentary, very moving. I recommend that. But one of the things that's interesting about your book is you really pull back a veil on the admissions process. A lot of people have accused Eva Moskowitz of cherry picking the best students. And that explains her test scores. One defense she could make, I'm sure she does make, is, well, it's by lottery.
Sure.
These are poor kids. I assume almost all of them are on food assistance.
Reduced price lunch, for example.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so she's taking some of the most challenging situations, students from the most challenging situations, and she can't choose them. They come to her by lottery, and yet, as you point out very, I think, adeptly in the book, she does something more clever than that. She chooses parents. And talk about the admissions process, because, again, if you hear about it, you think, well, it's a lottery, and some kids get in, some don't, and that's life. But they have some rather extraordinary things to decide who gets in.
It's super complicated, but it is worth unpacking. Because it does, I don't want to say it punctures the myth, but it's important to be clear-eyed about this. And look, frankly, this kind of goes against the ed reform orthodoxy, and I consider myself to be an ed reformer in good standing.
So ed meaning education.
Education, yeah. Thank you. So yes, there is a lottery. The rough number is there are six applicants for every one seat. But the lottery is not, first of all, I would argue, the second a parent raises his or her hand and says, hey, I want something other than my zone neighborhood school, that's one level of differentiation right there. You've got by definition, a motivated parent. So they start there and then they go several steps further. So once you you go through the lottery process, if you either are accepted or on their waiting list, which they call, not insignificantly, the likely list, we can talk about that, then you were invited to a welcome meeting. Not necessarily invited, you must attend. It's compulsory. If you don't attend, they may drop you if you're not communicative about it. That's the first of several hurdles. And at this welcome meeting, they do a lot of aggressive messaging about their culture, what they stand for, what they will not stand for, so to speak. Then you have to confirm your interest in email. Then there's a lot of paperwork you have to fill out. Then you have to come to a uniform fitting, even if you're just on the waiting list. Then there's a dress rehearsal for Meet the Teachers. And the math is undeniable. By the end of this process, you don't have a 1 in 6 chance of getting in. It's closer to 1 in 2. But what's more significant, Russ, and I think this is the thing that, frankly, Success Academy is probably unhappy about, this has been hiding in plain sight for over a decade, but it just it just seems pointless to deny that this doesn't have an effect on who gets in. Because success makes such prodigious demands on parent time, showing up for meetings.
No buses.
There's no transportation.
You got to bring your kid.
No after school.
Yeah.
You've got to read to your kid every night and log it. Your kid has to read 6 books a week and it has to be logged. They require an extraordinary level of parent commitment, both in time and responsiveness. And it just seems pointless to deny that some number of parents, this is simply too much. Now, I want to be clear here. This is not data. This is a journalistic observation. But you can see an observable difference in who makes it through the end of this process. Over the year I spent at Success Academy, there's a disproportionate number compared to what I saw at teaching in the same neighborhood of parents who are married, employed, what I would call religious or spiritual, ambitious for their kids. In other words, they are a critical mass of them are buying what Eva Moskowitz is selling. I'm not suggesting it's all of them, but it's a critical mass. They become kind of the culture keepers, so to speak. But that enables these great results. That I want to be clear. I'm not suggesting that it's, and it's clearly not, they're creating a self-selection mechanism for parents, but that's the starting line that makes all these other things happen. It's just a lot easier to get these results when every adult in a kid's life is pulling in the same direction.
But as you point out, and this to me is one of the more powerful parts of the book, as you point out, in wealthy suburban suburbs,
right?
That's the edge that all those kids have. Their parents are motivated. They have high expectations of their children. They send them to schools with high expectations.
They choose neighborhoods.
They buy houses accordingly.
Right.
And they expect their kids to go to a certain quality of college.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, they're going to college,
yeah.
And they're not just going to any college.
There's never been a day in their life when the kids didn't know they were going to college.
Yeah. And expecting to go to college, right. And expecting to excel. So what?
And this is all, Russ, unremarkable and uncontroversial,
right?
It's the water that we swim in.
We don't even notice it, right? We don't think, I think about it and you think about it, but most of us don't think about it. And I don't think about it as much as you do. But the point is that when people criticize Eva Moskowitz and Success Academy, and we're going to have criticisms over in this hour, there are a lot of things in the book that I think are very thoughtful on the negative side of what Success Academy is doing. But when people criticize it, one of the things they say, which I think is grossly incorrect, is that it's just not fair that a certain set of kids with these type of parents get this advantage. And your reaction is what?
Well, it is unfair. The question is, to whom is it unfair? Is it unfair when my kid and your kid gets the conditions we just described, that they have unquestioned access to educational excellence, either by purchasing it or by purchasing a home where your real estate taxes are your de facto tuition to a public private, as it were, school in a Bethesda or a Scarsdale or a Greenwich or some such. That's uncontroversial. We are used to, I'll say it bluntly, treating low-income people of color as a public resource in this equation. In other words, when a motivated child or parent, or when a motivated parent takes his or her child out of my old school and sends her to a Success Academy.
The one you taught in.
PS 277, we look at that and say, well, that's unfair. You're robbing the public school system of the resource that is this child. Now, you know, if I were a good education reformer, I would say, oh, no, that's not true, because we have all these studies that show that it creates a rising tide that lifts all boats, etc. As a teacher, I know it just changes the temperature in the room when you take that kid and others like them out of the room. So I have no problem just intuitively saying that's probably not true. There is a downstream effect. But, and this is a huge but, Russ, we don't have the right to keep that kid there because the kid is not a public resource. But this is the tension that exists in all of this work, right?
And the other, you know, to be fair to the critics, their other point, which has some legitimacy, and you've just conceded it, is that you can't attribute all of the charter school movement, or in particular this chain of Success Academy, their testing success. We'll talk later about whether that's the, you know, what that means, testing success as a measure, but you don't want to attribute all their testing success to the particular what happens inside that black box, which we will also talk about. Mm-hmm. You might be tempted to say, oh, all schools should be doing this. And the critics, and you as well, are saying, well, it's not a legitimate natural experiment because you have not controlled for having really motivated parents who will jump through 1,000 hoops to get their kids in the school. And my reaction to that, and I think yours is, okay. Yeah, but at least, and this is quite an achievement, and this is more than quite an achievement. This is should be a ground-shaking achievement with that cherry-picking of parents. Mm-hmm. They're able to get success on tests,
parents,
which is shocking.
Picking themselves.
Yeah,
I mean, I want to
fair
be
enough.
Really clear
yeah.
about that.
Yeah, yeah.
there is no mechanism that I uncovered that suggests that Success Academy is cherry picking parents and manipulating who gets in. Yes, they create these structures that functionally privilege parental bandwidth. This is when you make all these demands on a family's times. It's obvious, right? That two parent households are going to have an advantage and be more likely to persist, thrive in this process. That's just, I don't think that's a debatable point. But that's not the same thing as their cherry picking parents.
Yeah, fair enough. Now let's talk about what happened on the ground for you in this year. To show up at 8:30 every morning.
Yeah.
Tell me what you did and what did you have access to and what did you not have access
to? Look, give Eva Moskowitz and Success Academy all the credit in the world. There is this sense that they are secretive. That was not my experience. I made my pitch. They were somewhat reluctant at first, but I'm a persuasive guy, so they wore them down. And I got access to a particular school in the Bronx, which is, as a writer, I appreciated this. The school that I spent most of my time in, I visited many schools, but I spent most of my time in Success Academy Bronx 1, which is literally across the street from where I was a student teacher and a few blocks from where I was a fifth grade teacher. But very few restrictions were placed on my access within that school. The principal there was, she's still in Success, she's no longer at the school, Elizabeth Vanlick, could not have been more welcoming and just allowed me to wander about. Over time, I ended up returning to some classrooms more than others, and there were one or two classrooms that I just tended to avoid. And there was one particular teacher who she said, look, this guy's new, do me a favor and cut him some slack. But there were, as a general rule, there were very few restrictions placed on my observations.
And how many classrooms would you say you sat in the course of the year?
Oh, goodness.
We're talking about 5 or 50?
No. Closer to 50 than 5, because I also visited a lot of other schools, including going on several school tours with Moskowitz herself. So if you count those, then sure, well north of 50.
And you sat in on faculty meetings, right?
Yeah. It was kind of interesting. There's a scene earlier in the book on the first day of school at Bronx One where they are just giving withering appraisals of some of the teachers. And I'm looking around saying, is anybody going to ask me to keep this off the record? and they didn't, because it's the same culture they have with their adult staff. I mean, it is a pitilessly transparent adult culture. If you can't take it and don't respond to feedback, it's not the place for you.
And some of the names in the book are real. Some are not.
Almost all of them are real.
But
I changed the name of one teacher who, spoiler alert, flamed out and quit mid-year. Not even mid-year, a few months into the school year. Look, and that was just my own personal decision. I just, again, whether you love what they're doing or hate what they're doing, no 24, 25-year-old needs to see her name in a book as having, quit, in her first job.
For whatever reason, even if it was justified, understandable, doesn't
exactly
matter. So let's talk about what you saw. One of the and how Success Academy works on the ground. There are a lot of rules.
Yes,
it starts with the uniform, and it just keeps going. So talk about what they do institutionally, both in terms of training their teachers and in training their scholars. I love that word. That's what they call their students.
Yeah, that's pretty common in a lot of so-called no-excuses charter schools. I'm also – let's start there with what they do. They will deny that they are a so-called no-excuses charter school, which is a thing you used to hear 10 or 20 years ago. I think I'm the last person in education who still is okay with that label, mostly because I remember what it used to mean before it was co-opted. It used to mean no excuses for adults to fail children. So that's
disappoint them to not expect them to do well, to right?
Precisely.
You didn't mean to give them F's. You said failed children.
Fail them in the big, in the right. In the grand sense.
Yeah.
Like, lead them to disappointing outcomes.
Yeah.
That's on us. It's not on them. So I think that original ethos of the No Excuses Charter School movement was the correct one, and I don't shy away from that label. But I'm the freak there. Everybody else, you know, calls them high achieving charters or some such. But look, I think I said this in the book. Eva Moskowitz may deny that or repudiate that label, but Success Academy is not merely No Excuses. They're the most No Excuses. it is quite regimented. I document several instances in the book of kids being turned away because they have the wrong color sock. But that's not arbitrary and capricious.
Turned away on a particular day.
Yes,
right.
Yes,
they show up for school and you have to have the full uniform.
Yeah, full uniform.
It's blue socks, not black. And the black sock kid gets said, sorry, you can't come in today. And the parent who's there takes them home.
Yeah, yeah. Unhappily, but but takes them home.
And what's the justification for that if you ask Eva?
I will describe it in my own words. It's a culture-keeping mechanism, right? Another thing that we're not supposed to talk about in social policy anymore is broken windows theory. But, I mean, this is what that looks like, right? In other words, if you sweat the small stuff, then the big stuff takes care of itself.
Explain the broken windows.
Yeah, broken – and I'm not expert on this, so you'll –
But it's a metaphor.
Yes, exactly. this goes back to policing and that small disorder leads to large crime. And look, having been an inner city school teacher for several years, that rings true to me. Your typical inner city school can be a chaotic place, for very good reasons, which are obvious. But it does get in the way of learning. So the thing that Success Academy has really nailed is getting that culture piece right, both in terms of expectations, but it gets down to the level of the wrong color socks. They say several times, like, this shows that we're really serious, that our expectations are high, and it becomes a lived experience for the parents and students.
So describe what happens when the kindergartners come into their classroom on the first day of class, the second day of class, every day of class. The regimen of what's expected of them behaviorally.
Yeah, yeah. And
all through the school, it's not just kindergarten.
There's a lot of folks in the education world who are deeply uncomfortable with this, who consider it paternalistic at best.
And, fascist,
and,
racist.
I was going to say racist and fascist at worst. And full disclosure, as a classroom teacher myself, I was once described by an assistant principal as being an authoritarian teacher, and she did not mean to pay me a compliment in saying that. So I'm kind of naturally disposed to not being bothered by the sight of kids marching in straight lines and school uniforms and being asked to sit up and, as they say, track the teacher, monitor the teacher with his or her eyes. That doesn't bother me. It bothers a lot of folks because it's in the service of a greater goal. I mean, you need to have students' attention for them to learn, and we want them to have these good outcomes. So I'm okay with this, but a lot of other people are not.
Well, it can be jarring if you're used to a more chaotic classroom or quote livelier classroom even,
yes.
Or a classroom that has more self expression.
Yeah,
It's must be jarring.
But let me be clear. Moskowitz again is a controversial figure. Area in which I think she has been done dirt is when she says, well, look, we don't do this because we enjoy imposing our will upon students. This creates the conditions for learning, for joy, for participation. And she's absolutely right. I mean, I don't want to give the impression that every minute of every day the kids are sitting, ramrod straight and like an old cram school or some such. But it does set a tone that pays dividends.
So let's get back to that kindergarten. So it's you're paying attention. You're tracking, you're following the teacher with your eyes.
Yeah.
You can't daydream in this place very easily. You're going to be told to stop. What are also some of the forms of this regimentation that would make somebody uneasy?
Yeah, I think we just tick them off. I mean, a lot of people are just uncomfortable with any adult authority over children. I mean, I blame Rousseau, honestly. It goes back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and this idea that children are born with all the gifts that they ever, will need, and all we can do is mess them up. Not my vision of education, certainly not even Moskowitz's. Dewey, I guess, would be another person to consult here on this one. Look, this is, frankly, frankly, one of the reasons why, and I'm sure a lot of people are disappointed in this conclusion, that I don't think a Success Academy is scalable. Because remember, Russ, this is why we do all this in education reform, right? We're looking for the Holy Grail. We're looking for the model. This is what works, and now we must scale this up. I think these are very, very good schools for the population that they serve. Does that mean that every school should be a Success Academy? No, because you couldn't impose these conditions on the unwilling.
And not just that, I think, and this is the thing that haunts me when, you know, I talked with Paul Tough about the Harlem Children's Zone and Jeffrey Canada, their founder, what an extraordinary job he appears to have done. Eva Moskowitz, you can't scale them. And I think easily, at least, the ability of Eva Moskowitz to create a uniform culture throughout 47 schools is not easy.
No.
And just as I don't know if you talked about this, having spent that year in the school, you watch some kids struggle, you watch kids rise, you watch kids thrive. Did it feel like a happy place?
Yeah.
Or did it feel repressive? And because it could sound repressive.
The question.
Or oppressive.
I found it to be anything other than that. I think if you don't see the clear investment and the joy in these schools, well, you don't want to see it, honestly. And look, let's be candid. There are a lot of folks in this work who have, you know, deep convictions about what school should look like, and anything that is not that, you know, is going to set their teeth on edge.
But the scalability issue, even if you thought that this should be available for, say,
more,
100 times more.
More,
not everybody, but more. And I'm a big fan of choice, trial and error, let people find where they belong. And I think that's one of the biggest problems with the current system and universe of school choices for children. We just face this issue of if you thought this was an important option to have widely available, it might not be, it would not be easy to create. Eva Moskowitz's relentless application of what she expects of her teachers is part of what makes this distinctive.
We could spend several hours talking about the particular aspects of their model which make this work. But going back to one of the things we brought up early on, what I didn't discuss and what's remarkable to discuss is the consistency of this. In other words, and not within Success Academy itself, but compared to other so-called CMOs or charter management organizations, what makes Success an object of worthy of study is there's literally, Russ, no other charter school network in the country of this size that has that consistency of results. And in my mind, it has to do with that consistency of culture. There are charter school networks, I'm thinking of, say, KIPP or Yes Prep or Achievement First or Uncommon, that may be larger or comparable size, but there's always an outlier. There's always one or two weak sisters. So the fact that there's not one here is worth discussing.
The other part that I found so extraordinary is that I think of the 2,000 staff or 2,000 teachers in the year that, in the system that you looked at, 900
were new
or doing new roles, having new roles in the school. And they're under unimaginable pressure. I mean, it's hard to be a student in this school because the expectations are very high, but it's incredibly hard to be a teacher.
Goodness. Yeah, the turnover is prodigious. And look, that's a New York advantage. You couldn't do this in Utica. You couldn't do this in Youngstown, Ohio. When you have an attractive urban environment like New York City, that's, you know, every day you can go to Port Authority and, you know, find another 24-year-old who wants to close the achievement gap. I mean, I'm being glib, but you take my point. It's an attractive proposition, less so in other parts of the country. They really do work their teachers incredibly hard. There's no doubt in my mind that two things are true. I could never work there because I'm 57 years old. I can't work that hard anymore. But boy, do I wish I had trained there 20 years ago as a teacher instead of the training that I got from the New York City Department of Education and others. I would have been, and my students would have been far better off had I trained there.
So one of the challenges of being a teacher that most, I think, non-teachers can't appreciate until they've either been in a classroom or seen their own kids in a classroom, is classroom management. Oh, just man. By itself,
it's
is not straightforward in 2020, especially, or even in 2016 when you were there. And it can't be the whole thing, though. It can. It's a necessary condition for learning that there be enough quiet and calm in the room for people to absorb material, but it's not enough. And what did you see pedagogically beyond the conformity to certain norms of behavior? Mm-hmm. How would you describe what makes Success Academy distinctive and what they teach? Because you can have a really well-run classroom, but that doesn't mean you're going to get high test scores.
that's right. I mean, one just to complete the thought on the young staff, they seem to have cracked the code on getting really good results, test results, with relatively inexperienced staff. Not right off the street. You know, they have an intake process. They've got an assistant teacher model. You know, you're an assistant teacher before you lead a classroom. But they've routinized it in a way that a lot of other folks have not. I talked about some of the ways in which Success Academy is not a model for other schools, charter or traditional public schools. Well, here's one way in which they are. They have a curriculum. Now, look, this is confirmation bias on my part. I'm a curriculum fetishist.
Well, you've already confessed that when you were a teacher, you had to find your own.
That's why I became one.
It's horrifying.
Because, like, surely this can't be best practice. My particular interest in education as an analyst is curriculum and instruction. That's what I thought I was going to see at Success Academy. And I sort of did. Look, they make decisions in terms of their curriculum that are not necessarily the ones that I would make. I'm an unrepentant disciple of E.D. Hirsch Jr., who some of our listeners may know as the author of Cultural Literacy way back when. He runs or founded the Core Knowledge Foundation. This is the guy who says, broadly oversimplifying, that kids need a lot of background knowledge and they need a broad education in science and history and art and music, etc. So that's my flavor. Success Academy is not that, but they are, I think I say this in the book, they're a school that Hirsch would feel comfortable with. So that while they're not making curricular decisions that are precisely what I would make, they're pretty good. And their math curriculum, I've actually changed my thinking about math because of what I saw there. I think they're knocking it out of the park on math. So the significant factor is there is a curriculum. There was a RAND study done some years ago that showed that teachers, virtually all teachers, like 98% of teachers in America, are using materials they either created or found themselves in their lessons. This is where we need economists, right?
That's nuts.
That is a prodigious waste of time. Even if you are creating the best lessons known to man, unknown and unknowable, well, that's time that you're not spending studying student work, building relationships with students, deepening your own pedagogical
giving
skill
feedback.
And knowledge, giving feedback to students. There's not one thing I can think of that wouldn't be more valuable for a teacher to do than spend 10, 20, 30 hours a week with the empty plan book by his or her elbow thinking, what am I going to teach this week? That's got to change. And they don't do that at Success Academy. So they're
because they give you curriculum.
Well, there's a curriculum, and they make a great virtue of what they call intellectual preparation, planning to teach the lesson as opposed to planning the lesson. So they do all those things that we just talked about, giving feedback, developing questioning strategies, etc. If there's one thing that American education at large can and should take from Success Academy, it's that.
And in terms of the, let's get to the thorny question of teaching to the test.
Yeah.
They're really focused on the test at Success Academy.
Yeah, they are.
There are worse things. There would seem to be much better things. Did you feel, as you sat in those classrooms, that there was a roteness to the learning?
I mean, I'll be honest about it. When they say that, well, look, we don't really change our curriculum for test prep, that's technically true because their curriculum, at least their English language arts, their reading curriculum, is kind of what I call test preppy year round. But it was interesting. I mean, you know, I have a complicated relationship with standardized testing. Nobody should be sentimental for the time before we had standardized tests. That was just basically a permission slip to disregard the outcomes of low-income kids and kids of color. So, you know, it's not like there was this golden age of education that was destroyed by the advent of standardized testing. Having said that, I refuse to pretend that it isn't having a downstream effect in terms of narrowing the curriculum, in terms of, you know, reducing a child's education too often to, you know, just a whole lot of reading, math, and test prep and not much else. And that's not okay either. So on the one hand, I could look at a Success Academy, and I did. This kind of tracks exactly my experience. They did a lot of test prep. They did a lot of kind of routinization, things that I might not ordinarily like. And I found myself, I think I actually said this in the books, like, was I falling victim to Success Academy Stockholm Syndrome? Because at the end of the day, it didn't seem to bother me that much. And the reason it didn't, Russ, is because when you look at the big picture, there's something powerful about large numbers of low-income kids of color in a neighborhood like the South Bronx all doing well, and I'm making air quotes as I say doing well in school, because I mean doing well on standardized tests. But that's the conditions we've imposed on schools. You know, we've told them, you know, by their test scores shall we know them. So nobody should fault an Eva Moskowitz or anybody for the pursuit of test scores. That's how we keep score, and that's what we do. But come on, there's got to be some powerful downstream effect of being a low-income kid of color and going to a school where I do well. Everybody I know does well. All my teachers are in on it. All my parents are in on it. It just changes the complexion. It changes the relationship of a community with a place called school. You know, I talk about this at some length in the book. There's no reason, right, for a low-income kid of color, his or her parents, to expect anything other than a bad relationship with a school in this country. School is where you go to find out how little is expected of you, how limited your horizons are. And now suddenly you've got a place called Success Academy. Love them or hate them, that's not the experience. The experience is, and you're not being told this is easy. You're being told, hey, look, this is hard, but we're going to prepare you. And you're going to get a level 4, which is the highest level on your math and reading test. And then test date comes, and you do, and all your friends do. And surely you must go home thinking, look, not only am I good at school, but this is a good relationship with a civic institution. This is going to take me someplace.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan of the self-esteem movement, but it counts for something. I guess the way I would phrase what you're talking about, which I find, you know, very powerful, is it's a championing of mastery. You can debate whether it's a mastery that students should strive for 100%. That is doing well on tests. That's not the only thing that's worth mastering, but too often, children in America master nothing.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking.
And look, there's an open question right now in education circles as to whether or not a high score on a standardized third through eighth grade math or reading test translates into attainment, as it were.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah.
Does that mean you do well in high school when it's not a Success Academy high school? And more importantly, and you talk about this in the book, do you do well in college?
And
the story there is not so clear cut.
Unknown and unknowable. I use the example of KIPP. I mean, the first cohort of Success Academy kids are only, as we speak, sophomores in college. So it's not like we've got a large N size here to know whether or not they're going to be successful in college and later life. But we're gonna learn a lot more about this soon, I think, through the experience of KIPP, which is about a 20-25-year-old, again, chain of so-called no excuses charter schools. They're kind of the leading edge, and they've put thousands of kids to and through college. You know, by their own metrics, they're not as successful as they wish. I think, again, from memory, they want to get to a point where 75% of their graduates are graduating college. I think they're given 50 a good hard shove right now, but I would bet, and here's another question for economists, that within a couple of years, we should have the data to look at the life outcomes of the first couple of cohorts of KIPP kids. Not just college, but broader life outcomes, employment, marital stability, substance abuse, incarceration. I would bet you a prodigious sum of money that you're going to see a real effect from not just the test scores, but the culture of those schools and that productive relationship with a school.
Well, we'd like to think so. We'll see, I guess. It's a good question. You mentioned the focus on reading and math. Reading and math are really important. There's more to life than reading and math. These schools have chess, art,
sports, every day,
other things. Give me a thumbnail of how that those subjects are experienced by those kids, given that they, you know, my joke is, one of my favorite stories is that George Allen, the former coach of the Washington Redskins, when asked if he sends Christmas cards, said, "I don't send Christmas cards. They don't help you win football games." tells you a lot about George Allen.
That's focused.
And if you're the owner of the Redskins, that was probably a plus. You know, if you were a neighbor, maybe not. Maybe it told you something else about him. Not so interesting. A little narrow. So art doesn't help you pass the math test.
This is where I'm going to disagree. And this is why I describe myself as an unapologetic disciple of E.D. Hirsch Jr.
Go for it.
There is no such thing as wasted knowledge. Literacy is knowledge. This gets to stuff that I've written about ad nauseum over the years and I can now bore myself with. But there's this general misconception out there right now, and frankly, driven in no small measure by standardized tests, that reading is a skill, that, you know, you learn to decode, translate the words on the page into language, and then you practice reading strategies, and then you can read anything. It just doesn't work that way. This is Hirsch's critical insight, that language proficiency and reading comprehension has much more to do with shared background knowledge and vocabulary. That it's not enough to know, the words and the 26 letters, but you have to have context. The best
example, big theme of Daniel Willingham, who was a guest on the program talking about that a long time ago.
Yeah, I often think of the two of them in the same breath because, Hirsch is the theorist and Willingham is the guy in the white lab coat who says, well, Hirsch is right and here's why. a study that I first heard of from Willingham that I always use when I talk about this is kind of the hammer through glass moment for a lot of folks. There was a baseball study about baseball done with some, about 20 years. I think the researchers' names were Recht and Leslie. And I won't bore you with the details, but it basically showed that low ability readers with high content knowledge of baseball vastly outperformed high ability readers with low content knowledge of baseball on a standardized test. In other words, the knowledge of baseball made the poor readers look like good readers. And that's counterintuitive because you think, well, reading is reading is reading. It doesn't matter what you're reading about. It matters prodigiously what you're reading about and whether or not you have background knowledge about that topic. So art matters and music matters and science matters and history matters. It all matters.
Yeah, it all matters, but it matters less, one could argue, in the sense that hours spent on sort of art history would maybe allow you to understand an essay that referred to Van Gogh or the Mona Lisa or whatever and do well on a standardized test. But time spent drawing would seem to be less so. Time spent playing sports, less so. Time spent playing chess, less so. Did you feel that those activities in the school were sort of thrown in there because, we got to have this? Or was there passion about that for the students' experiences in those?
Oh, sure. Look, I don't know about you. I couldn't tell you a single thing I learned in high school, say 10th grade, but I could tell you every play I worked on. I was part of the theater department in my high school. My daughter is an athlete, and I'm sure she would say the same thing about her high school, but she remembers every volleyball match. Yeah. So kids need a reason to go to school, besides, reading, writing, and arithmetic, as it were. It is terribly engaging, and it's closer to that rich experience of school that we all want for our children, right? I mean, look, this gets back to my conflicted relationship with standardized tests. I don't ever want to be the guy who says, let's stop testing because we need that data, but it should concern us when we allow our children's schools to reduce their education to just reading and math and take away all that stuff that gives kids a reason to get out of bed in the morning and want to go to school.
But it's not your impression that Success Academy has somehow has a thin version of those things?
No, not at all. Look, I think the thing that makes a big difference for them in terms of how this gets translated into standardized test scores is, and there's a chapter in the book that I call The Window in the Mirror. As a teacher, I was trained to believe that the reason that my students, and again, I taught in a school where fewer than one out of five children were reading on or above grade level, we were led to believe that that was, well, that's because the kids are not engaged by their reading. So you need to let them read whatever it is they like and bring this to life. In other words, you're selling them on reading. I'm oversimplifying, but you know, for a purpose. So that's the mirror. In other words, everything should reflect the kid's experience back to him or her. Now, this, by the way, this makes great sense even in the Hirschian model, because of course you're going to be a better reader when it's about stuff you know about. The problem is if you're not leading kids to the stuff they don't know about, you're kind of forcing mediocrity upon them. You're limiting their literacy. So if that school of thought is the mirror, well, what you see at Success Academy and other good schools is the window. You're forever directing kids' attention not in the mirror, but out the window. In metaphorically speaking, you know, that's where the science, the history, the art, the music, all that stuff comes in. You're saying, in effect, to a kid, look, there's lots of interesting stuff going on out there, and we're going to bring it into you to expose you to it. David Coleman, the head of the College Board, has a lovely phrase that he uses to describe this. He describes to restoring elementary school teachers to their rightful place as guides to the universe. And that's a nice metaphor. And that's what we should be doing. And that is what you see at Success Academy. For all its faults, there is an orientation that we're going to direct kids' attention out the window, not in the mirror. And look, it's also a reading culture, just an extraordinarily high volume of exposure to print. And that's that pays dividends too.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. But at one point, you talk in the, I can't remember how you bring it up, but you talk about how the standardized tests, we've talked about some of the problems with them. One of the problems that you mention in the book is that they can get dumbed down to make schools feel better about their performance.
Yeah.
Did you feel that what students at the Success Academy were reading in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade were serious books as opposed to, quote, not serious books that were, you know,
yeah, probably more so
things
at the
to grapple
school
with,
level.
Things and, to grapple with.
Yeah, I was focusing more in the book on the elementary school level, just because as a practical matter, I think that's where the battle tends to get won and lost. I mean, you tell me how a kid is doing at the end of 3rd grade, and I'll tell you how that kid's going to do almost certainly for the rest of his or her educational trajectory. So it's on us to get those early years right. But yeah, as a general rule, the reading is rich and complex. Pitched a grade level or two above where you would expect at that level. And again, they also just valorize tonnage. I mean, there's a reason that they want those kids to read every night, have parents read to the kids every night, log everything. You know, there's no such thing as bad reading, so to speak. I mean, at the risk of wonking out on you here, the number of rare and unique words that you see in even children's books is more sophisticated than the language of college graduates conversationally. I mean, there's tons of data on this. So the way that you grow background knowledge and vocabulary is through volumes of reading.
Yeah. Did you get the feeling that parents actually did the reading as opposed to just logging it?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. if they didn't, they'd have heard about it. Yeah. No, this is They are on them. And this is, look, another part of the culture that some people find repellent.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, how dare you make these are people with you know, complicated lives,
yeah,
and whatnot, and how dare you impose on them. This gets to be another complicated part of not just the Success Academy model, but the way we conduct ourselves in education at large. Look, I don't have data on this, but my impression, having been in this work for a number of years, is that the dominant mindset in education, even among good charter schools, is, look, we can't make demands on parents. And that can take one of two forms. Either they don't have the time and I'm being humane, or I don't think very much of them and they're not going to add value. I mean, I say this all the time, but I fear that the soft bigotry of low expectations hasn't gone away. We just apply it to parents now. Either way of thinking about that, you can't pin that on Moskowitz. I mean, she clearly expects a lot of parents. She does not have any impressions that they can be anything other than helpful partners in their education, their children's education. And it shows. It shows in the way they treat them. It shows in the – you can say they're making extraordinary demands, or you can say, nope, we are bringing you in and we are getting you to contribute.
One of the things I found striking is there's no parent-teacher conferences. Explain why.
Well, because they have FaceTime all the time. I mean,
how?
Yeah, at least at the elementary school level, every day at pickup and drop-off. I think we alluded to this before, but there's no transportation. And these are charter schools, so you know the parents have to bring the kids there at 7:30 in the morning, pick them up at 3:45, half a day on Wednesday, etc. There's no after-school programs. There's no transportation. And it's just the culture that if they want to see the parent, they see the parent. They take out the cell phone in the middle of the day and say, "Hey, you need to come see us at dismissal." If they want to do something for the entire school or class or grade, they have what they call an upstairs dismissal, which means they hold the kids in the classroom. And if you want to come get your kid, well, you've got to come up to the classroom and talk to the teacher first. I saw that a lot.
No after school activities?
Not at the
elementary school.
No sports team?
No.
Yeah. They have competitive teams at the middle school and high school level, but not at elementary school.
Yeah, interesting. Example, I want to talk about scalability for a minute. I want to read a quote from the book, which I think about this a lot. I think scalability is just, and what we mean by scalability is if you have a particular model, it's one thing to do it with, say, one teacher. Can you do it with the staff? Can you do it with the chain of schools? Can you do it with the school system? You say at scale, teaching must be a job that can be done well and competently by people of average sentience and talent. Mm-hmm. That is who we have in our classrooms and all we are likely ever to have. One of the claims that's made is what we need to do is get the best people should be in the classroom. And of course, I think about this, this example I got from, it's a book on entrepreneurship, can't remember the titles, by Michael Gerber. His insight, which is a brilliant insight, is that the reason McDonald's is successful is that it doesn't require a fabulous, talented manager to run it. It requires a talented manager, a reliable manager, a person who's trying, but they've created a system so that a pretty skilled person can provide a reliably good hamburger every single time. You don't want a system that gives scope for the genius of the manager, unless you got a lot of them.
Yeah.
And by definition, you don't have a lot.
That's right.
So I think what's impressive potentially about what this model is that this insight, and talk about it, is that you don't want to rely on the best and the brightest in any field. Forget teaching is easy to pick on as an example, but in any field, you want to make sure you need a lot of these folks. You're not going to have a lot of talent by definition.
3.7 million. That's a big, big number. There are not 3.7 million classroom saints and superstars out there. And I get myself in trouble when I make this observation because I don't want people to perceive me as thinking ill of teachers. I am a teacher of decidedly average sentience. Look, it is what it is. I invoke Donald Rumsfeld all the time, making a joke about this. You go to school with the teachers you have, not the teachers you wish you had. So our job has to be, and I like the McDonald's analogy, except then it creates the impression, oh, you
don't
want to
stamp
McSchools. You don't want to do McSchools, but you want to make this a job that somebody can come in and be successful at relatively quickly. Because you're absolutely right. You're not going to get those saints and superstars. You're not going to get the geniuses. And if you get them, great. Leave them alone and let them do magic. But there aren't 3.7 million of those. I think this is where we're just missing the boat in the education reform world. Because we are either nervous about condescending to teachers. We think that they don't want to lose their autonomy. It's interesting. I wrote a story a couple of years ago for a magazine called Education Next that made almost exactly this point that we are, I think the phrase I used was that we were making teaching too hard for mere mortals. And I expected a considerable amount of pushback. I gave a talk and I got a standing ovation for this, like for making this what I thought was going to be a controversial observation. And people are like, at last, somebody is recognizing how hard we have made this job. It really is beyond the cognitive ability, the way we configure it, that not only are you going to design your lessons on your own, you're going to differentiate for every skills and need in your classroom, et cetera. It is literally beyond the ability of ordinary people to do this job competently.
I want to talk about the significance of that insight that you don't want to rely on superstars. There is a belief, I think it's an easy belief for a principal to have if they're not good at their job, that good teachers, great teachers, either one, they're born, can't make them, you know? And so the goal, and I think a lot of economists feel this way, you just got to get the best teachers into the classroom. My view has always been that you want to get good teachers into the classroom and you have to teach them, influenced by Doug Lamov. Mm-hmm. You've got to teach them how to teach. Very few people do that naturally. There are people who are passionate about their subject. There are people who are well-versed in their subject. That is not nearly enough at the K through 12 level mm-hmm. to be a great teacher. It requires a pedagogical toolkit and a classroom management toolkit. Do you think that toolkit can be taught to people who are just pretty good at it right now and can get better?
Well, I think,
or is it just something that comes naturally?
Yeah, no, I don't. I think what comes naturally is a desire to do the job and, you know, an affection for children. Folks who don't like kids should probably consider, you know, accountancy. You know, not teaching. Let's start with that. But assuming that you're walking into the job with a certain amount of goodwill and you want earnestly to do right by kids, then yeah, I do think that we would be a lot better off if the schools of education were Lamovian. You invoke Doug Lamov's name. If they really had that more nuts and bolts, and I don't want to suggest that he has got this kind of, you know, that he's viewing education as plumbing. Doug's a much more sophisticated thinker than that. But we are unused to thinking of teaching as a suite of skills, and that's critical. I do think we would be better off if we thought of teaching, frankly, as more of a craft than a profession, a noble craft, you know, an important craft. But a series of moves, and as opposed to a disposition, this idea that you're a born teacher. I don't see any evidence for that.
I'm not a big fan of schools of education at the graduate level, and I'm not a big fan of the requirement that teachers have a
nor am I
master's degree or teaching certificate.
There's no evidence that it pays any dividends,
and I don't think it does. Not only does, I think there's no evidence, I don't think it does. Could you imagine an academy for teachers that would teach them how to teach rather than something that taught them, say, the latest theories of education, which is what I think they learn in grad school? Those theories are often rejected, wrong, misleading, have unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. But just this toolkit of, we call it the plumbing part, the skill set of how to master a classroom, how to run a classroom, how to retain student interest and attention. This sort of, Doug Lamov spends a lot of time, and other charter schools spend a lot of time on giving the teachers in their system a unified both vocabulary and toolkit, which also allows them to help each other because they're speaking the same language. And I found that very powerful. Do you think that's a good strategy that we ought to be thinking about?
Yeah, without question. But I was an adjunct professor for a couple of years working with first-year Teach for America Corps members at Pace University while I was still in the classroom and shortly thereafter. And that's all they ever wanted to talk about was classroom management, because that was the one thing that their pre-service was not giving them. So, you know, that's what we spent most of our time talking about is how to run your classroom. I think the Relay Graduate School of Education, which was founded out of Uncommon Schools, where Lamov worked with Norman Atkins and David Steiner, who's now at Johns Hopkins. I'm fairly sure, I haven't been in one of their schools in a long time, but I'm fairly sure that was their mindset as well. And they do have this idea that teachers should be prepared for the skill of teaching as opposed to, you know, the art and disposition and whatnot. So I think it's better than it was, but by no means is it anywhere where it needs to be.
One of the issues we've talked about on the program before is how the teachers see their students. There is a tendency, I think, at the college level and sometimes in high school to see your job as, I'll say grader, the one who does the grading, that, you know, separates the students into different piles. Mm-hmm. The really superstars, the okay ones, the ones who are satisfactory or mediocre, depending on whether it's half full or half empty, and then the people who are not acceptable haven't reached this level. And I think this requirement that instruction has, particularly in K through 12, to assess and to judge, causes there to be, if often in in elementary and high schools, an adversarial relationship between the teacher and the student. And I think that deters a lot of students from excellence. And, you know, my wife and I talk a lot about this. She's a high school math teacher. That when the students feel you're on their side, mm-hmm. that all you care about is that they learn, it changes everything. They no longer see it as a fruitful strategy to annoy you because they don't see you as an enemy. And you may have trouble convincing them that you're on their side because you are going to sometimes give them a bad grade or send right. them home or ding them for behavioral misbehavior. But I think you said earlier you have to like kids. I think it's so much more than that. It's you have to root for kids. You have to. It's a little like it's like being a great coach rather than a great teacher. A great mm-hmm. coach is wants a student to get everything out of their gifts that they can, and the student feels that. Do you think that's true? And did you feel that at Bronx One?
Yeah, I think it is true, although it's challenging because let's not forget we're talking about a public policy or a public institution that gets funded to the tune of $700 billion a year across the country. So it's very, very difficult to, just let 1,000 flowers bloom, so to speak, and let every teacher, do it his or her own way. It's just naive to think you're not going to have a certain set amount of performance extracted from this prodigious investment we make in school. So it's complicated. Look, in terms of what I saw at Success Academy, this to me was the thing I saw at Success Academy. I actually coined a phrase for it in the book, which I was surprised they let me leave in the book. And you may...
Yeah, you can't say it on this program, actually, because it's a G-rated program. Okay. We'll call it CAL, care a lot.
Yeah, yeah, the care a lot factor. Why weren't you my editor, Russ? It's just impossible to spend a significant amount of time at one of these schools and not be struck by the profound level of investment that the adults in Bronx One had in their children. And I don't care, this may not be your favorite flavor of education, but if you can witness that level of caring and just deep investment in kids, then if you don't see that, you don't want to see it, is what I think I said. So it's unmistakable. Now, it may take a form that you don't like. You know, this is about...
It'd be counterproductive, yeah.
It's the parents who are signing up for this are walking with both eyes open. They clearly... Look, when you were saying before about, your own wife's experience as a teacher and getting kids on their on your side, let's be honest, a lot of us feel that way, but we still want our kids to do well on their SATs, right? So...
Oh, right. No, that's what I mean by on their side. I didn't mean... there's a separate disease I think teachers are prone to, which is to want their students to love them like them, to look up to them, and to think they're cool. And I think we do that as parents sometimes. And I think that's a very destructive, that's a misunderstanding of what your role is. To go back to the recent episode with Yuval Levin, I think if you want to be true to the institution of parenting, true to the institution of education and teaching, you should see your role as it's a tough love role. It's what can I do for you, not what you can do for me. And what I can do for you is to help you thrive.
No, that's right.
And maybe more than a test score, but it's not, I'm going to give you an easy grade because that way you'll be my friend.
I'm a collector of what I call teaching homilies. And one of the ones that grates on me the most goes something like, they won't care what you know until they know that you care, which is lovely.
Yeah.
But,
makes me want to vomit, actually.
There's a lot.
Even though it's a parody of what I just said.
Well, that's right. Yeah. That's right. You know, it comes from a good place, as they say. Look, at the risk of appearing hard-hearted, I think my own kind of transition as a teacher, I became a lot more effective the moment I stopped trying to make teachers kids like me. When I had that my own kind of Damascus Road conversion on that. There is a danger. You hit the nail on the head in thinking that if they like me more, they will work harder for me. Some will, some won't. There's a lot of moving parts here, I'm broadly in agreement with you on that.
It's a great moment in the book when you were on the sidewalk with a parent dropping off their kid for the first day of school. This is in after you've been there a year. So it's the, you've come full circle. Obviously, every parent is uncertain whether they're making the right choice for their kids. And this is a case where you have to make a choice. You either apply for this program or you don't. You send them to the local neighborhood school or you don't. And you never know what the right thing is. You don't know what's right for your school. You tell honestly, powerfully about students that didn't fit in behaviorally and whether the Success Academy treated them in the right way. It's complicated, obviously. There's no simple answer. But this parent standing on the sidewalk meets you, finds out you actually know something about the school and wants to know, did I make the right choice for my kid? And you wanted to hand the book, but it hadn't been written yet.
Yeah.
and if you had, it would have been like, well, maybe it depends. Because that's what I think is so, I said at the beginning, it's a thoughtful book. There are many times where you confront the complexity of this.
Sure.
It's not easy to decide what's right and wrong or whether it's good for all students, some students, which students. So here you are. You got this customer saying, did I do the right thing? What'd you tell him?
Yeah, look, I said it was a great school because I think it is. Let me temper that.
But I'm going to, I read the book finished the book last night, you said, I started to tell him about all the, there's certain, this I'm not so crazy about and there's this. But then I realized,
the time.
It was just two dads on the sidewalk. And as a dad, the answer is it's a great school.
This book, and it came out now a few months ago, so I've been asked this question a lot. And usually it's in the form of a gotcha question for people who don't like Success Academy. They say, well, Pandisio, would you send your child to your school?
Where was that question?
My answer, I don't mean this to be an evasive answer. It's an earnest answer. It's, well, what are my options? In other words, would I send my daughter to Success Academy Bronx 1 rather than her very nice Upper East Side of Manhattan private school? No, I wouldn't, and neither would you. Would I send my kid to Success Academy Bronx 1 instead of PS 277, where I taught for 5 years? Of course I would, and so would you.
In a heartbeat, yeah. In a half a heartbeat.
But this gets back to that mindset there's a right and a wrong way. And I just think that's naive and nuance averse. What we should all want, I would argue, is for low-income parents who are the folks who tend to have the fewest options, the least range of choices. I want them to have exactly what I had. I want them to have the ability to look at schools and say good, better, best, not, oh my God, that one's horrible, and there's my lifeboat, which is the condition that we broadly speaking, tend to impose on people with the least amount of choice in our society.
So we've talked mostly about public policy. We've talked about the pedagogy of teaching and how these schools were run. I'm going to close with asking you what the year meant to you personally as someone who's still in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it affected maybe your view of charter schools. It may have affected your view of, I assume it had, it gave you a much more richer view of what was actually going on inside the black box called Success Academy. But did it change you as a teacher? Did you have takeaways that you didn't expect that were that you think will stay?
What a great question. And now I have to answer this off the cuff when I would normally say, that's a great question. Let me come back to you in a day or two and give that some thought. I do think it gave me a renewed appreciation for the incredible complexity of this. I wrote a piece before the book came out or about the same time it came out for a website called The 74, which was an education news website. And the title of the piece was a little bit puckish, but I meant it. It was, here's my new book. I hope you hate it. And the reason I gave it that title was because regardless of where you are in your views of ed reform, charter schools, traditional public schools, etc., we tend to want to reduce this to one of two narratives. You know, there's either the narrative that, and you hear this in New York City a lot because a lot of schools are co-located, charters and public schools in the same building. So you hear this idea a lot that, oh, the only difference is the door that the kid walks in the morning. They walk in this door, they get a good outcome. They walk in that door, and it's a bad outcome, and it's what happens, you know, beyond that door that makes all the difference. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that, obviously. So it was useful to remind myself, and I hope to remind readers, when I say, here's my new book, I hope you hate it. Well, if you are a believer in one of those two narratives, you will find things in this book that will confirm your priors.
Yeah.
My hope is that you will also find things in the book that will call you to question your priors and make you reevaluate some of those. Look, we all want what's best for kids, right? This is complicated work. If you forget, it will remind you how complicated it is. But I just don't think those two narratives have served us very, very well at all. And my hope is that through this book and through my own thinking, that we can get to a place where we can be a little bit more honest and come up with some new narratives that reflect what's actually happening as opposed to what we think should be happening.
Well, I'll let you tell me in a day or two, and you can put it as the first comment on this episode, but I'm curious if any of your priors changed.
It's a question of being reminded. I think like anybody else in the ed reform world, who is, and look, I say this in the book too, I am staunchly pro-choice and pro-charter. But it was good to remind myself how difficult the work of folks outside of that world is. You know, as I think I alluded before, when folks in neighborhood schools say, look, we're dealing with, you know, all the concentrated effects of poverty and dysfunction, our job is harder. They're not wrong. They're right about that. And I think a lot of us in the ed reform world have been insufficiently mindful of that. In other words, it just will not do to say, well, look at the great results this charter school is getting. Why can't you do that? You're not as good. Well, they have different challenges, and we should be mindful of that. I used to know that because it was my lived experience every day at PS 277. So it was good to remind myself of that.
My guest today has been Robert Pondicio. His book is How the Other Half Learns. We didn't talk about how entertaining it is. It's really beautifully written. Robert, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you, Russ.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.